We're on the telephone with Joseph Sisk, who farms near Hopkinsville, Kentucky. Joseph is also a director on the Kentucky Corn Growers Association board and also serves on the Kentucky Corn Promotion Council. And Joseph, the reason I called is I saw your response on Facebook to the New York Times article from over the weekend that, well, frankly, it was kind of tough on genetically modified crops. Made a number of statements basically saying that when you compare Europe, parts of Europe that have no genetically modified crops, and the U.S., where, of course, we are pretty reliant on GMOs, that there's not a lot of difference in the crop production that's going on. Now, you noted in your comment that you've actually had a chance to visit parts of Europe and visit with farmers there. So talk about that, if you would.
I was fortunate enough in the last 2 years to go with corn growers, with the Kentucky corn growers to southern France, where we met with corn producers in an area that has been historically corn behind corn production. And they were just foaming at the mouth to be able to get their hands on genetically modified corn because of their corn borer infestation. And they were in an area of the country that had very deep topsoil, very moderate temperatures. They would have been as cool as most of the, you know, Midwest, central Indiana, central Illinois, and yet they were not producing any more corn than we do here in Western Kentucky. And so it was obvious to us that the shortfalls in genetics were extreme in that area, and that all the producers that we came into contact with the different cooperatives that we met with, were all on board with that they understood the science behind the safety of GMO crops and that they wanted GMO crops, but that they were farming for a society that had a non-farm sector that was willing to pay through subsidies for them to not be as productive as they could be. And I just, you know, that has continued to stay with me since we left there. And the New York Times article was comparing the entirety of the U.S. to Western Europe. And for those that have been in those areas, in Germany and in France, those could be incredibly high-producing areas, especially for corn. And they've just chosen to not have them produce as much by restricting their farmers from using technology.
So what you're saying is, they were comparing apples to oranges, that they should have been comparing, as you indicated, central U.S. prime farmland with European prime farmland.
That's exactly correct. And, I mean, they were 100% on board with that. They knew that their yields would go up if they were allowed to farm it for all that it could be farmed for. And I guess the takeaway from it for all of us that were, for everybody that was on the trip, was that in the U.S., we feel that there, let me go back. We feel that in the U.S. there are regulations that we don't like, that we're scared might stifle our production. But for the most part, we get everything out of an acre that we can get out of an acre. There's nothing here prohibiting us from getting all we can from an acre. And in our visits to Europe and what we were told by individual producers there, the non-farm sector, especially when it goes to using technology, were limiting their ability to produce what they could on an acre. And so when you read that, especially in a New York Times piece, and I think that it was noted that it was written out of London, but, you know, in the New York Times, when you see something like that, people are going to take that and assume that it is all well-researched and that it's all true. I had a friend who posed the question to me about it because he knew how enthusiastic I was about American grain farming. Posed the question to me about, explain this to me. Why is this not correct? And it was a great question, and I'm glad he asked it. And we need more of these conversations in America about our farming and about grain farming in particular. And I was answering him that, when you read that as a non-farmer, you are going to assume that everything in that, especially the way it was written, was, non-biased, university research kind of information, and it's not. And you know, if you compared the entirety of the U.S. to a specific part of South America or Europe where they had the highest potential for grain production, any comparisons you make are bogus. I mean, there's nothing there that could be used. It would never be used in any real research.
And they also noted in the article, they used some statistics showing, you know, while pesticide usage has and fungicide usage has dropped in the U.S. because of GMOs, that herbicide usage is up. And of course, that's the use of mainly the use of Roundup. But you noted again that that's a little deceiving.
I feel that it is deceiving. I have a grain farm, and we are, for the most part, we're using glyphosate with hay mixes, same as everybody in the Midwest. But the types of chemicals that we're using now are so much safer than what we would have been using prior to the introduction of GMOs. You know, in the early 90s, mid-90s, it would be the same on any farm. The safety of the products that's on our spray trucks and that are in our sprayers and that the employees use on farms across America, those products are safer than they've ever been. And a lot of that is attributed to the fact that we're using GMO products, especially when it comes to insecticides. You know, we were fighting these bugs that we now fight through technology. We were fighting them with insecticides. And that was true for anybody, anywhere in the Midwest. And thankfully, we're not having to do that as much anymore, you know, because of genetically modified crops.
And when you say safe, not only safe to the user, but safer to the environment?
I think safer to the environment, safer to the employee who's or the farmer who's applying the product, and definitely safer to the consumer. I mean, I would always hope that there would never be anything on any food products. That's what we test for and make sure of at all levels. But if the end user has a concern about what has been applied to the crop during its life, what has been applied to the crop since we have actively started using genetically modified crops in the U.S., those products versus the products that were applied to that crop before are much safer. And I don't personally believe that before we started using genetically modified crops that there were any dangerous residues in the food supply. That's always been watched, and you know, farmers all across the U.S. would, you know, their families are eating this food also. So I don't think that that was ever a concern to begin with. But we have a segment of the population that seems to be their concern has been what has happened to that crop during its life cycle. Well, if that is their concern, what's being applied to it now is far safer than what was applied to it prior to the introduction of GM crops.
The other thing you noted here, and doesn't get mentioned in this argument very often, is how this has allowed folks to reduce tillage, no tillage in some cases, and the improvement that's made environmentally.
That's correct. When we were in southern France, it was almost overwhelming the amount of tillage that was happening there. They're afforded the use of no herbicides, hardly at all. And so they do a complete tillage before they plant corn, and then they are still actively row cultivating the corn during the crop. So any major, any big rain events that happen, we all know what's going to happen in that case. And they have incredible amounts of erosion. They have very low levels of organic matter left. They're completely turning loose all of their carbon. Their carbon footprint is extreme. And here, the focus, I think, of most any American has been to continually strive to improve the environment. And through the use of no-till or strip-till or minimum till, all of these things have been afforded to us because we have the ability to use these chemistries to control the weeds in the crop. Because without some control of the weed in the crop's going to fail. And our ability to control it without having to till the soil has had a great environmental impact as far as, you know, in any sediment that it was entering waters before, as far as any nutrient runoff. Those is so important to us. And then this big push to maintain and retain the carbon on these acres, it would be completely unavailable to us if we were not able to use these chemistries. And GM crops have made those chemistries available to us during the crop year, which they were not before.
The article also left the impression, I think, as you read it, that the big seed companies and chemical companies have kind of forced farmers to adopt the genetically modified crops.
You know, I have a lot of contact with non-farm people, non-farm friends, who in the early parts of conversations about this have accepted as fact this argument that the American farmer has been forced into this collusion with whether it's Monsanto or Syngenta or whoever it may be. And my statement to them has always been that if no matter what the company is, not giving anybody any endorsement, I think that farmers in general are really proud of the fact that these industries have produced these genetically modified crops that allow us to do so much better job and be so much friendlier to the environment, that we see it as a real plus. We don't see it as something that someone has been shoving down our throats. I raise non-GMO crops. We have for the last several years. We have some this year. Someone is paying us extra to do that, and we are working with that and trying to maintain that through our no-till system, and it's tough. And but they pay us more because it doesn't yield as much. But as a whole, I think that the argument that we're being forced into it, that there are no choices, I think it's real condescending to the U.S. farmer. I think the U.S. farmers, when someone makes a statement like that, it's almost like the poor farmer doesn't know any better. And when it comes to the environment, especially in the environment on a farm, no one knows it any better than the U.S. farmer. And so that argument has zero validity with me, and I think it does with most farmers. If we don't make good arguments against these falsehoods that come out, then I think that we are being irresponsible towards American agriculture. I think we are the most exciting part of American industry. We have to use our resource every year. We don't use an acre and then go buy another one the next year. This thing has to be there for us every year, and it has to be in as good or better condition next year than it was this. And until we get that message out and make the non-farm community understand that, and for them to understand that we aren't, to make the non-farm part of our society understand that we are very, very well educated about the way that these companies market, and that we understand that the genetically modified crops, how they work, and that we aren't using them because we don't know any better. We've chosen to use them because we think they're better for the environment and that they're, you know, much more economically viable. Until we go and start actively fighting against that, I think it's bad for agriculture. Now, we can't do it in a condescending way, and so, you know, you have to be careful about how you have to go after somebody. If someone like my friend, when he asked a good question, he asks, how does this work? You know, why is GMO okay? Why do you use GM crops? If the answer is condescending, if the answer is we know what we're doing, leave us alone, you are leaving them to go find their own answers from people that don't know, and it makes things worse. But when people actively put out information that is incorrect, I think we have to refute it.
Do you plan to respond to the New York Times?
I don't know. That's tough. You know, when you go on a little rant on Facebook, it's one thing, but to actively respond to the New York Times, I don't know how that would work, you know. My sister who lives in New York, that was her first reaction, was you should drop them a letter and see if they respond. So maybe I will. I don't know.
When were you in Europe?
We were there. It was last summer. It was last July.
Okay.
It was July of 2015. And I want to say something about that. These producers that we came in contact with in France, they were brilliant producers. They did a fantastic job with what they had. They were just as bright and intelligent and, you know, as any of us. It was just that they were operating inside the box they had been given to operate inside of, and it was just painful to watch it, especially since they knew it was a box. You know, they knew that they were in this container that they couldn't get out of and that they couldn't make as much crop as they ought to be making. It was hard to watch, and it was a very eye-opening experience for all of us about how far the non-farm, you know, how far non-farm society can pull a farm away from what it ought to be doing. You know, Europe's much older than us, obviously, everybody knows that. And so in a lot of those areas, the people are many more generations away from the farm than we are here in the U.S. But it is a place that we will go in the next 200-300 years. And, you know, as far as our society goes. And so we have to be able to, you know, going to Europe and understanding what's happened there and how the people that are 10, 12, 14 generations off the farm are affecting the farmers. For us to understand that, it's really important, and it just it really drives home the fact that we have to get our message out, a good positive message about what we're doing, because we are doing a fantastic job. We're doing a really good job for the environment, and as we learn new things and better ways to do it, we go do it. And I think it's a real credit to American agriculture, and it needs to be talked about more.
Well, and you make an interesting point there, too. You know, you have some of these states passing right-to-farm legislation, and opponents say, well, you know, there's no problem now. Why are you doing this? And they're, in a lot of cases, they're saying, we're not worried about now. We're worried about our children and grandchildren.
Yeah, it's absolutely valid point. And you go somewhere like Pau, France, and you will see that. I mean, because they'll tell you that they're dealing with people who can't go back far enough in their ancestry to find someone on a farm. Well, if those people are passing your laws and passing your regulations, I mean, what good regulation or what good law could come from that? And so it's important, and it's definitely relevant to us here, and it will be as we go forward over the next generation, you know, next 3, 4, 5 generations.